all kinds of excitement going on there.
Scores! Roll the highlight reel. 6-0 Flames.
Here it is. Put it in the wind column.
Yeah, baby. Yeah, baby. Yeah, baby.
This is Flames Talk with Pat Steinberg and Aaron Vickers on Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Okay, we are underway this hour. It is Thursday, October 17th. Welcome to Cowboys. Welcome to the 22nd Eric Francis Pizza Pig Out. And welcome to this hour of Flames Talk with Aaron Vickers of NHL.com. My name is Pat Steinberg. Welcome to the Sports Drive brought to you by Calgary Lock and Safe. Treat yourself with up to $500 in savings of fire-resistant gun safes. Explore the full line of safes at Calgary Lock and Safe. .com. And we're going to kick off this hour talking goaltending because that has been one of the stories for Calgary's 4-for-4 start to the season. Solid goaltending. And that's why we're bringing on our goaltending guru, Kevin Woodley, right now. We bring him on every Thursday, so we would have been doing this anyway. But the timing is really good. Kevin Woodley, In Goal Magazine, NHL.com in Vancouver, joins us right now. Mr. Woodley, how are you?
I'm good. Not as good as you guys. At the Pizza Pigout sounds like a much better location than my basement office right about now.
It is one of the best events of the year, so I can confirm that we're in a good spot on this Thursday. Hey, it's funny. ESPN.com put out a ranking of their 32 goaltending tandems duos in the league. They did that on Thursday, and you know, lots of intrigue when you put out a ranking like that from a publication like ESPN. So they put out their top 32, and the tandem of Dustin Wolf and Dan Vladar comes in at 29th overall. We've got our goalie guru on with us. I got to ask you, what do you make of that 29th overall ranking for Wolf, Vladar, and Calgary's goaltending tandem?
Well, I mean, first thing I'd say is they have the potential to make it look like a bad pick, right? Like, we know what the upside is, and yet when you look at the lack of track record for Dustin Wolf, some of the ups and downs that came in his early exposure to the NHL, and some of the natural expected ups and downs you have with first taste of the NHL. And then I think, honestly, with Dan Vladar, I just think the lasting impression is last year. Not enough recognition is maybe given to what he was playing through. And I think there's just been some really good stretches in there that not a lot of people really recognize. And so when you look at the picture as a whole and on the numbers, without being able to adjust them for sort of the environment that he played behind, from the outside, I get it. You know, I understand that they'd be in the bottom third. Honestly, once you get into that tier, it's kind of hard to pick and choose where you put them. But they're certainly a tandem that, and I think this is even one of the, so I guess I'm just agreeing with one of their insiders or analysts, because I think one of the quotes was they're a tandem that has the ability to make a 29th ranking look silly by the end of the year, right? And doesn't guarantee they will, but I think long term, and we're seeing it early this year, I think they're more capable than maybe a lot of outsiders might give them credit for. I'm a big believer in Wolf. I did see that one quote about people not being convinced he's an NHL guy, and that ain't me, right? So you guys know how highly I think of him, mm-hmm. and as much as there may be some ups and downs along the way, I think that he's going to be an NHL goalie. I know they've been convinced, you know, and even internally, I think there have been times where they will say to what degree they weren't sure, but that they were convinced he was an NHL goalie. And I used to hear, this is the comparison I'll make, I used to hear that a lot about Saros. Like, NHL goalie, people I trust with organizations, guys with long history of success sort of breaking down and analyzing the position, would look at Saros, and even as he was sort of rising up behind Pekka, they'd be like, okay, he's an NHL goalie, but is the upside capped by the size? Like, is there a limit to his upside because he's on the smaller end of things like Dustin Wolf? And, you know, here we are probably 5 years later from having heard that on a regular basis when he was, you know, in more of a backup role. And I think he's proven that he can be an NHL number one goaltender. So we'll see where Wolf gets, but that's sort of the comparison that I make. And at this stage in his career, it's real easy to have those doubts. I'm not one of the people that has them.
What have you made of the first four games for the tandem of Vladar and Wolf so far?
pretty much like it's, I actually don't even know what the raw numbers are, like what it says on NHL.com, but
yeah,
well, slightly above expected, sort of flirting with the top 20s, and Dan Vladar's just slightly under. What's impressed me the most, like they've been good, but the environment's also been pretty good, especially for Wolf. Like his expected save percentage right now is 911. Vladar's is down there closer to league average at 888. So whether it's the team playing well in front of him or a mixture of that and opponents, like Wolf's had a bit of an easier go at it in his two starts than Vladar has from a shot quality perspective. I think what's impressed me the most is that environment overall for the Calgary Flames. I think a lot of people thought that it might not matter what the goaltending did because they'd be exposed by what the team was in front of them. And early on, and it is early, and you know, only a couple of opponents, and let's see Seattle tonight. They put up a couple of big scores against teams. Seattle on Saturday, they put up some big numbers on a couple of teams. But right now, defensively, you know, they're mid-pack 5-on-5, high-danger chances against. They're not giving much up off the rush, especially. The only category where they give up the most chances in the league, or the, you know, is low danger. And that's one where you don't mind giving up the fourth most chances, because those are the chances you want to give up, the easy ones, the low percentage chances. So, you know, defensively 5-on-5 expected goals against, 10th in the NHL, rush chances 5-on-5, 10th in the NHL, D zone 14th, PK 10th, like top half, top 10 in the league in a lot of major categories. I'm not sure a lot of people would have predicted that. And I think if that can continue, then that gives your goalies a good chance to have success, because the environment in front of them is a little more predictable than I think a lot of people would have predicted going into this season.
Kev, I did some sleuthing, and it turns out Dustin Wolf has a 944 save percentage. I'm just curious, from your perspective, what signs do you look for that tell you that Wolf is on when he's between the pipes?
See, there you go. And that's so like 944 jumps off the page. And I think some of that, and it's impressive. Like, you'd actually nothing against it, but that's like, you know, top of the league type stuff. And I think adjusted numbers are a little more, you know, edge of the top 20. So,
yep.
Again, they've been really good in front of them. To me, with Wolf, it's just sort of set, as quick as he is, as fast as he is, when he's sort of set and tracking into pucks, moving into pucks, patient on his edges, that's a key to a lot of goaltenders games, but especially him. I think we do tend to think of smaller goalies as having to be more aggressive, having to move more, and I think the pace when he does move, like, it's so impressive how much power he has, and he gets that from keeping his edges under him and full access to them and full range of sort of the ability to push off of them. But it's about not overdoing it, right? It's about not chasing. It's about not sliding out of position. It's about not being overactive. And so to me, it's control. And I've seen that even when some of the rebounds have gotten away from him or come off of him, he's keeping them in front of him. And it's a quick recovery or a quick subtle movement to be right behind it again. And just, there's a lot of things in his game right now that look really clean, really controlled, and honestly, really confident for the level. Like, there's no signs of this being too much for him early on.
Would this be a fair paraphrase to say he's on his game when he's looking boring or his game is quiet?
I think that's true of a lot of goalies. I think because of the quickness involved in his game, I would agree with that. I just think because he's so quick, I'm not sure other people see that. So if that's what you're seeing, that's a good sign. Because there is, like I said, there is so much pace there that it's always going to look fast. And so people sometimes confuse quick with not being in control. And so, yeah, the patience to hold edges and wait for plays to come to him, to not be over aggressive, to stay in his lanes positionally, which means sort of if you were to draw a line straight up the ice from the goalpost, to sort of always have one, his inside skate inside of that, so he doesn't get outside of his post, quote unquote, and just lets plays come to him. Yeah, if that's what you consider quiet and boring, you know, it's never going to be Connor Hellebuck, who likes to call himself the big boring, but that's, you know, I think a lot of goalies would say that's how they play their best. And I think a lot of people might not assume the same because of Wolf's size, and I would agree with that.
Right. We're chatting with Kevin Woodley. He is our goaltending expert in Goal Magazine, NHL.com. He joins us Thursdays here on Flames Talk. Let's pivot from the Flames, Kev, and focus in on the big goalie news around the league, and that is Jake Oettinger and his eight-year extension. It's a familiar-looking contract, 8 years, $8.25 million as the goaltending market continues to reset itself, eh?
Yeah, and it's kind of, I mean, I think Swayman gets a lot of credit for it. I guess if we were to look back, it's actually, you know, it's actually a market that was set by Ilya Sorokin at 8.25, and maybe Connor Hellebuyck at 8.5. Although I would argue he's probably, at the way he's performed in his career, the guy who should be alongside Igor Shesterkin pushing for a bigger piece of the pie. But when he settled at 8.5 and Sorokin at 8.25, it seems like that's just the new standard for, you know, quote unquote elite tier goalies. And now the question becomes, or the task for general managers is, you have to be careful or smart about who you give that contract to. And, you know, we saw it. There was a period there where it was 5x5, right? Demko got it. I think Merzlikens was a little above it. You know, and then the one contract amongst all those guys that sort of settled at that, what was the standard mark for sort of young elite level guys coming up, Cal Peterson gets it. And obviously that's a contract that hasn't aged well. Even if at the time right. There were a lot of signs and it was a small sample, that a lot of people liked it. Now, like Jake Oettinger, we all see how good he can be. We've seen it in playoff series in the past. But in the last 2 years, like last year, he was right at expected. 2 years ago, he was 30th in the league at plus 0.9%. You know, last season, playing at expected for him, you know, just right at basically what you'd expect of a league average goalie, like 58th in the National Hockey League. Off to a great start this season. Statistically, you look at it, there's so much to like about his game and his size and the package he brings and the mentality. I love talking goaltending with Jake Oettinger. And again, off to a great start this year. But that's a team that's defended really well. And so a lot of the numbers that put him in that stratosphere of an 8.25 by default guy are team product. And when you filter out shot quality, it drops at least for the last 2 years enough that, not to say you're worried about it just because you know who he is and the work he'll put in to keep trying to stay at that tier, but these are some we're starting to get closer. The fringe isn't fair to him, but we're starting to get closer to the edges of that conversation where I don't think he'll be the guy, but somebody's going to make a mistake. Somebody's going to go 8.25 based on a small sample and find out that that's not the guy. Interesting decision coming here in Vancouver where Demko has got 2 years left on his deal. He gets to the end of this year and he's eligible for one of these extensions, depending on how this year pans out and still hasn't been healthy enough to even be in a practice yet. This is the number he'll be at. Do you dare pay it for a guy who hasn't been able to get through a season healthy yet? So this tier is high enough now that it creates, you know, if you miss on one, it's pretty punitive.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, punitive. By the way, you mentioned the 5x5s. Vix went and looked up one other one. Jack Campbell in Edmonton got that 5x5 as well.
Yeah, and is an unrestricted free agent. But even that year, right, like Jacob Markstrom, as you guys know, was the highest paid UFA, as yep. I would argue yep. the only legitimate number one in that UFA class, and he just got six, right? So yep. I think it was, you
six
know,
by
in
six.
Part depend. Yeah, in part to sort of the pandemic and what it did to the cap and the way the cap was sort of kept down for so long there, and in part sort of this trend towards tandems and do we pay a number one, but it stayed artificially low for a long time. It's up now, and I think everybody has to accept it. It's just, you know, what tier do you want to play in and where do you think your guy fits? You know, the secondary tier now I think has been established. Like Joey Decord is arguably, you know, is he a peer number one? Is he more 1A, 1B? Well, he's 5x5 now, right? So as this shifts, you're going to have to be really smart in your decision-making as a team because all of those numbers are enough that if it doesn't pan out, especially with the term involved, that's a big ticket to hang on to for a long time.
Two more for you, and one's a fun one. So we saw a goalie goal on Tuesday night, Philip Gustafson from crease to crease, and he scores the first ever Minnesota Wild goalie goal. That was awesome to see. And we have seen more of these in recent years, and Mr. Woodley, you've picked up on a little bit of a or a couple of trends as to maybe why that's been the case.
Well, this is the first time we've had three straight seasons of a goalie shooting a puck into a net. We've had goalies credited with a goal in four straight seasons in the past, but two of those were own goals, and they were the last one to touch the puck. So in terms of goalies actually shooting the puck into the far net, this is the first time in NHL history it's happened three straight years in a row. And with it happening so early this year, it's also the earliest one in the season. Gustafson, I think he beat Mike Smith in Arizona by 4 days on the calendar year back in 2013. There's lots of time for us to get a second one this year, which would also be a first in NHL history, which had me wondering, is this just going to become more common? Because goalies can all shoot the puck. I talked to Alex Nedeljkovic last night, who has scored three goals, two in the AHL and one in the ECHL. You know, are we going to see this more commonly? I talked to Jake Allen, who handles it really well. And it was interesting because they believe that, like, more guys can make that shot, almost every guy in the NHL. There's a hand for you now. The difference is the guys that used to be able to make the shot stood out as great puck handlers. Now the guys that can't make the shot stand out as poor puck handlers. And that's just the way that skill as a goaltender has evolved. And really, if you think about it, it's not just about shooting the puck the length of the ice, getting it over five guys and landing it at the far circle, which is where all three of those shots were, inside the far top of the circle. I think Jari was at the hash marks. Ullmark was well inside of it. Like, just launch 20 feet high in the air. That skill, as much as goalies will work on it, horsing around in practice, but that skill is pretty much mandatory, not for shooting on the goal, but for a hard rim from behind your net. If you don't leave it for a player coming back or make an over or an up, forehand or backhand, you get in trouble. We saw Jari give up a goal because he didn't do it quick enough last night and got his pocket picked. Your safest bet is a hard rim off the glass, because by the time it gets sorted out or a team collects it off the glass, even if it's the other team, you're safely back in the net. So you haven't risked getting caught out.
Right.
And so every goalie is taught and has a stick and the belief that they can just quickly elevate it up high off the glass with enough velocity to often clear the zone, but certainly get it out of trouble. So that skill has been ingrained in these guys. So why aren't we seeing more of it? Teams are pulling their goalie down two now far more often, sometimes with 3-4 minutes left in the game. The opportunity's never been greater. So will we keep seeing this? And the one common denominator, one reason we might not, is that all three of those goals were mistakes by the offense. Look where they're scored from. Tuesday night's was by far the most egregious. Neutral zone faceoff, no pressure coming in on the forecheck, and the guy slaps it right into his chest. Catches it, drops the knee, fires it. It's textbook. It's how goalies practice shooting. Like, coaches shoot it, they catch it, they drop it flat, and they fire it. Look at Tristan Jarry's. Poor dump in, handled right at the side of the net on his forehand, launches it. Linus Ullmark, he does a little more work. Again, dump in, pass, deflected, doesn't get to the boards, catches it out in front of his crease. He's got to go further. He's got to rotate more to get on his forehand, so it's a tougher play. All three of them, above the goal line. Alex Nedeljkovic, all three of his goals in the minor leagues, above the goal line. Doing this, as Pekka Rinne did 5 years ago, as Mike Smith did before him, from behind the goal line, like actually catching a hard dump in around the boards and having enough time to launch it over everyone with six guys coming in on the forecheck, is still incredibly hard. Where these goals are happening is when teams don't get it deep and make that mistake. Almost every goal in the league can do it if you put it, play it to him anywhere near the top of his crease, and that's where all these goals are coming from. So as much as I want to give goalies credit for the skill, and they have it, unless a team makes a mistake on the dump and on the forecheck, they are far less likely to keep happening.
Last one for you, my friend, and that's on Andre Vasilevsky. As you think there's some pretty good reason to expect a bounce back year from one of the best in the world, hey?
There is, after watching him play the Canucks the other night. And I'll be honest with you, when I did some of my own preseason work for one of the weekly hits I have. We do it usually in August where we go through the rankings. And, you know, I kind of fell off a cliff for him with the back surgery last year, and I wasn't as confident in their whole, you know, goaltending one through three. But I watched him last night, and I was aware of some of the changes he'd made to his training in the offseason. He reached out to Adam Francilia, who works with Connor Hellebuyck and about a dozen other NHL goalies on sort of off-ice training, but biomechanics, bringing it on the ice. And, man, I mentioned Hellebuyck as big boring earlier in this conversation. Did I see a lot of Connor Hellebuyck movement, control, patience in Vasilevsky's game? He's always been a freak athletically, incredibly skilled at reading pucks and reading plays. But he had a tendency to rely on that athleticism a little too much, to get low and wide in his stance, to drop his butt and lose his hands a little bit. Right now, there's none of that. He's narrower, way more often, way longer in sequences, which gives gives him access both with his hands and visually to pucks way longer. And it just, like I said, it's a one-game sample, and maybe I just watched the best game of the season against the Canucks for him, but he just made it look so easy that I was thinking big boring watching him. And yet when I pulled up the results at the end of the night, the chances were anything but. Like, there were some good ones there, and he just made the game look so simple. I do believe for him at that age, coming off the back surgery, there was a recognition when he reached out to change what he does in the offseason that, you know, I'm not going to be able to succeed relying on these natural gifts forever, and that I need to change the way I'm doing things. And it's translated not just into how he trains, but into how he plays. And again, tiny sample, but if we see more of that as this season goes on, I would not be at all shocked if he's in that Vezina conversation when it ends.
Great stuff as always, Kev. Really appreciate the insight, man. Thanks so much for doing this, and we will talk to you next week. Have a great weekend, hey?
I will. Make sure you guys have a slice for me and maybe bid on some of that fantastic merch that Eric has for all the people there tonight for a great cause.
Absolutely, we will, and we'll talk next week. Thanks, Kev.
Thanks, guys.
That is Kevin Woodley. He is our goaltending expert. He joins us every Thursday here on Flames Talk from In Goal Magazine and NHL.com. And he joins us, as always, thanks to, the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline, using the same secret recipe since 1975 at 6060 Memorial Drive Northeast. Enjoying the game at home? Call for pickup or delivery at 403-248-3344.
Flames Talk is live on Calgary's hockey station, Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Thursday edition of the program continues with Aaron Vickers of NHL.com. It's Pat Steinberg from Cowboys.
Yeah, we are.
22nd Eric Francis Pizza Pig Out. Lots to dive into. We spent a lot of time out on the first hour of the program, but Sam Hanzak week to week with an upper body injury. And you know, one thing that you and I didn't get an opportunity to chat about in the first hour, that I feel so awful for the guy.
Yeah.
Like, didn't have an entire year wiped out, but, you know, had a lot of his first year, draft plus 1 year with the organization kind of hampered because of injury. He got injured in training camp last year, then got injured again during the season, so did not play a lot of hockey last year. And when he did play, it took a little bit of time for him to get up to speed, so on and so forth. So this year, he comes to camp. He's the story of training camp, earns a spot on merit out of camp, plays his first four NHL games, and in his fourth NHL game, sustains an upper body injury, and now he's on the shelf week to week. More than anything else, I just feel awful for the guy that's the way this thing has gone.
Well, and I remember talking to him at development camp back in the summer about how it felt almost like a wasted development year for him, and the pressures of being a first-round pick and trying to come out and be a really positive prospect in the pool for the Calgary Flames, which had pivoted to retooling. He only played 46 total games last year, including playoffs, both for the Giants in the WHL and one game with the Wranglers in the AHL. That includes the World Junior Championship as well for Slovakia. But it was just such a stop-start season for him, where Sam Hanzak wasn't able to gain any traction, wasn't able to gain any momentum, and put some of the things that he was learning maybe off the ice into practice on the ice, and it just became a situation where he was always sort of, not necessarily fully behind the eight ball, but when you're a prospect and you're in arguably your most critical season of development,
and you're just ramping up, then stopping, then just ramping up and stopping, it wears on you physically, but it also wears on you mentally too, because there's a lot of downtime for a 19-year-old, an 18-year-old at that time going, oh man, what's next? What's going to happen next? And why can't I sort of start going the right way? So he has such a standout camp for the Calgary Flames, makes the NHL, and then has another setback. And it hopefully isn't as lengthy or problematic as what we saw last year for Sam Hanzik. But yeah, you absolutely feel for a guy who's finally trending the right way and the way he wants to be going, and then is sidelined week to week.
Yeah, I really do feel awful for the guy. Presumably hurt on the hit collision with Connor Murphy of the Blackhawks on Tuesday, a situation where Murphy had the puck, Hanzik went to hit him, Murphy being the bigger guy and the more experienced NHL guy, all of the thicker, stronger, all of that kind of stood up, held his ground, and Hanzik took quite the lick on that hit. He got blown up, and we saw the reaction from him on the bench. He was not happy and
broke,
smashed
his stick.
Yeah. Now, I was not expecting to get this news. Like, I was not like, oh, I wonder if Hanzik is going to be out long term or something like that. So I was a little surprised when I saw week to week on the designation, and I was wondering more about Coleman or Uyghur or Pospisil as opposed to Hanzik. But it's Hanzik's the one that ends up being injured here for a little amount of time. Any problem with the hit? Just a hockey play in my eyes.
No problem at all. And again, I think you described it perfectly, where it was a seasoned pro and a guy that has man strength and has finished his body development going against a player that's still junior eligible, that's still learning some of the ins and outs of the physical play at the NHL level. So no problem with the hit at all. Just an unfortunate outcome for Sam Hanzik.
Yeah, really unfortunate outcome. Now, does have some benefits. Benefits the wrong word. It does have a trickle-down effect. Number one, Matt Coronato gets the promotion to the line with Kadri and Kuzmenko. So that one seemed obvious. Seemed like, okay, well, if Hanzik's going to come off the line and you don't want to mess with your top nine too much, because why would you? You're 4-0.
Right.
The obvious candidate to bump up is Coronato, who's scored twice and looked really good playing in a fourth line role. Up he goes, and so Coronato will presumably play, at least start Saturday's game in Seattle with Kadri and Kuzmenko on the right side, which just seems to make sense.
Yeah, and what an opportunity for Matt Coronato. And I know, trying to figure out lines through the summer, one of the questions I had is, where does Matt Coronato fit on this version of the Calgary Flames? And that was even before Sam Hanzik's sort of arrival in training camp. Injuries happen, but it's an opportunity for another player, and that opportunity is being presented to Matt Coronato in the sense of he's going to be elevated to a line with Kadri and Kuzmenko, as you mentioned. And I've really liked what I've seen out of Matt Coronato through two games of the regular season in a fourth line role with Ryan Lomberg and Justin Kirkland. But now it's a little bit different. The expectation changes a little bit. You're going to see more ice time. You're going to see more offensive zone starts, and it's a credit to Matt Coronato, too, because I felt like he started really strong in training camp and faded a little bit as training camp went on.
Right.
But he gets into the regular season in that fourth line role and shows really, really well, to the point that when one guy goes down in that top nine, Coronato positioned himself to be the guy that gets elevated.
By the way, on Coronado's numbers so far, he's played two games on the fourth line with Kirkland and Lomberg. In those two games, the Flames on the ice with Coronato out there have been more than a 55% possession team. Goals have been 3-0 Calgary. Expected goals over 69%. High danger scoring chances 8-2. And that's all with a zone start under 37%. So a lot of defensive starts when Coronado's been out there. And yet the Flames have been very much in the black when he's out there. And then in two games individually at 5-on-5, 6 attempts, 2 shots, 5 scoring chances, 3 high danger scoring chances. He's been an impact maker, so it's the obvious guy to go up there. And the other thing about Coronato that I think is important to point out is that, at least in my eyes, he looks more like a guy that is ready to sustain being an impact maker over 82 games, as opposed to last year started really well and then it kind of trailed and tailed off. And so I kind of feel like, with some of the work that Coronato did last year, some of the learning that Coronato did last year, and learning to be a pro with some of that time, a good chunk of that time in the American League, all of that comes together, I think that he's better situated to stick in the NHL all season long.
To me, he looks faster first and foremost, and that is an absolute necessity when you're skating, you know, at the NHL level versus the AHL level. He looks more comfortable, and he learned a lot of these lessons the hard way last year as a first-year pro, where he did make the Calgary Flames out of camp, and then after the outdoor game and one more game against the Dallas Stars, gets demoted back to the
and
AHL.
He only got into that Dallas game because there was an injury.
Yep.
He was going to be sent down, but then he did play the one more game.
And then, again, spends the chunk of the season in the American Hockey League. And granted, that's still a very valuable time spent in the AHL, because not every player, regardless of whether or not you're a first-round pick, jumps immediately to the NHL in a full-time role, but sort of refines his game and learns his game a little bit more at the AHL level, then comes back for that last month and a half of the regular season. And to me, he looked better then, and he took that, brought it into the summer, and now has emerged. And again, small sample size of only two games, but the returns have been positive for Matt Coronato and the work that he's put in.
Well, and this text comes in from our buddy Mick, who says, yes, a start-stop season for Hanzek. Then why isn't he with the Wranglers developing properly? Rushing this kid does him no good, just stalls development. Now, Mick, I don't think they rushed him. I think he earned an NHL spot out of training camp.
Yeah.
That being said, to Mick's point, if they were to put him back in the American League after this when he's recovered, I don't think, and I'm not advocating for that. I'm not even suggesting that his play should put him there, but he did just take an NHL level open ice hit, and he's now on the shelf for a couple of weeks, maybe going down to the American League after the recovery and spending some time down there where the pace isn't quite as high as the NHL, but it's still higher than the Western League. The physicality is still very much NHL level. The grind is still difficult. Again, not quite NHL level, but more than the Western League.
Yep.
All those things together, maybe some time after the injury in the American League isn't the worst thing for Hanzik if that's what they decide to do. I'm not suggesting that's what they will do. That is something that I don't think is out of the question after he sustains this injury.
Yeah, and to your point, I don't think he was rushed at all either. He showed through training camp that he was deserving of one of those 13 forward spots on the Calgary Flames. And let's say hypothetically he doesn't get injured and he still continues on and he tapers down a little bit. There's no problem sending him back to the American Hockey League then, the same way that they did Matt Coronato. NHL games are very much a learning lesson and a development lesson, although you'll hear a lot of coaches point out that the NHL isn't necessarily a development league.
Right.
I have no doubt if Craig Conroy and the Calgary Flames look at Sam Hanzik and go, maybe he's better off developing in the American League than the NHL, they'll have no hesitation, just like they didn't have any hesitation with Matt Coronato, moving Sam Hanzik down to the American Hockey League with the Wranglers.
This text reads, Sam's head whipped back pretty good. I can see him having whiplash or concussion symptoms. People who haven't had whiplash don't realize how much it affects you. I'm not going to play doctor, but yeah, could it be one of those things? For sure. Could it be a sternum thing, a shoulder thing? I don't know. I mean, there could be any number of things that he's dealing with. All we know right now is upper body injury for Hanzik. Coronato gets the promotion, and that also opens the door for Adam Klapka to come back in. Because for Klapka, it's not like he played himself out of the lineup. They wanted to rotate Coronato in the Edmonton game with some fresh legs. They did. Then Coronato played really well, so kept his spot in the lineup, then played really well again. But now with this, again, I'm not suggesting it's a good thing anybody gets hurt, because it never is. But now with this, an opportunity for Klapka to come back into the lineup, and he's earned himself regular NHL playing time too.
Yeah, I don't think Adam Klapka coming out of the lineup was an indictment on what Adam Klapka was able to contribute in the first two games of the season, but you mentioned second of back-to-back nights, fresh legs, maybe you want a faster-looking Calgary Flames team by putting Coronato in versus Adam Klapka, and injuries just breed opportunity for other players. Again, you said it, you never want them to be a situation where an injury derails a player, but it is a next man up mentality. Adam Klapka comes back into the lineup full time, reunited with Ryan Lomberg and Justin Kirkland, and I thought that fourth line together, that combination of those three forwards, was quite good in the one full game that they've played. But for Adam Klapka, you get back in the lineup, you get a chance to go again, and you got to make the most of those opportunities.
Yeah, and I think that he'll step right back in and be just fine because he's been really good for them in that role. And it also answers our question, hey, we spent two straight days on the roundtable wondering, geez, how do you keep Kirkland in? And then he goes out on Tuesday, so we asked it prior to the game on Tuesday, like, okay, how do they keep Kirkland in? And so then he goes out and has another really good game against the Blackhawks. So we asked it again on Wednesday, you know, how do you keep Kirkland on this roster? Well, that's why you always have to factor in when having these conversations. Injuries happen. This is the National Hockey League. It is the most high-impact and most physically demanding it has ever been. And guys get hurt. And you never want to see guys get hurt, but every single guy who plays in this league understands that there is a risk of getting hurt and spending some time on the shelf. And so that's what opens doors for other guys. And it was a Rooney injury that initially opened the door for Kirkland. He stepped in, and so far through three games has done nothing but make the most of it. And now this injury to Hanzek is what's going to keep the door open for Kirkland to stay on the roster. And for the time being, no way you can take this guy out of the lineup. He's playing so well.
I mean, if you had a full complement, I'd still have a hard time 100%. Coming up with an argument for taking Kirkland out. Scores his first NHL goal at age 28, 10 years, a decade after getting drafted. Follows it up with an assist and multiple block shots, including two in the dying minutes of the game to help preserve, and two really like full-on sellout blocks in terms of diving in front of it to make sure that puck doesn't get by you. That's the kind of stuff that energizes teammates. And you ran through the fourth line in terms of what their metrics are. They have been an absolute positive line. They have not been underwater at all. They've gotten buried with defensive zone starts and managed to push the puck north. And Justin Kirkland is a massive factor in all of that. He absolutely deserves to stay in the lineup. And again, injuries, you never want to see them happen. But it's a next man up mentality, and this keeps Justin Kirkland in the lineup for the Calgary Flames, which is 100% warranted in my mind.
I know there's been a lot of talk about potential recalls and things like that. Kevin Rooney returned to practice on Thursday, wasn't a no contact jersey, but sounds like Rooney's pretty close, and thus I don't know if you should be expecting a recall necessarily, because if Rooney's close, they don't play again until Saturday. It just would stand to reason. Maybe you just keep the roster spot open. Right now, with Hanzek moving to IR, they'd be at 22 on their active, and then you've got the spot open to just, boom, put Rooney back on. So I know there's been a lot of talk about Karens, who had the hat trick, or there's a lot of talk about Pelche and stuff like that. Not suggesting those are bad suggestions, just don't know if now is the time that you necessarily need to go down the recall road. We'll see, but I'm guessing they don't go recall road this time, just because Rooney sounds like he's pretty close to being able to play again.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Max roster is 23, so the second you activate Rooney and designate him ready to return, you're back up to that 23-man roster, which means what is the corresponding move if you were to recall somebody? I just don't see it happening with, again, we get the sense that Rooney is close. Just the simplest action is activate him, you're at your 23, and you're good to go.
Last point, or last thing to touch on, would be what we saw practice on Thursday in Canmore. Flames did an event out in the mountains on Wednesday, so they didn't practice Wednesday, did an event out there, team dinner, all that type of stuff, then practiced on Thursday morning in Canmore. They'll be at Winsport on Friday before they travel to Seattle, then play against the Kraken on Saturday night. But we saw one tweak. So we obviously saw the Coronado promotion, and we saw Klapka come back in the fourth line, but that was by necessity. But in terms of a choice move, we saw a lot of fourth pairing time for Daniil Miramanov, who has been stapled on the right side of Mackenzie Weegar through the first four games of the year. Tyson Barry on the right side of the pairing with Mackenzie Weegar at practice Thursday, and Daniil Miramanov on the right side with Joel Hanley on the left. So that interesting to see as well. If Miramanov does end up going down the healthy scratch road, what does that, or what's your reaction to that? What's the reasoning for that in your mind?
To me, I'd be fine with it. One, you have eight healthy defensemen on your roster right now, so you do want to work Tyson Barrie back in a little bit. If it does come at the expense of Miramanov, I'm okay with that too. Like, to be perfectly honest, I've been lukewarm on Miramanov so far this season. He's been outscored 3-0 at 5-on-5, and he just hasn't been a difference maker for me. And when you're pairing somebody with Mackenzie Weegar, I think you want to see a little bit more out of the partner in that pair. So if it takes a one-game sit to sort of reignite or reset Miramanov, that's okay. There's always, to me, a benefit of watching the game from up top because you get to see things from a little bit of a different vantage point. And again, you need to keep this competition going on the blue line because that's what keeps everybody hungry. Nobody gets a chance to be complacent at all. And if that's the case and we see Miramanov sit, to me, he hasn't been impactful enough to be frustrated or think that it might be a negative move in the long run.
It honestly is, as you mentioned, a product of seven guys that you feel are everyday NHLers. With the Tyson Barrie signing, you've got seven guys that you feel can play on a nightly basis. And unless you go 7D, which right now the Flames aren't interested in doing, you need to sit one every night. And most of the time through the first four games, that's been Barrie. They've already rotated Jake Bean out to bring Barrie in against Edmonton on Sunday. And I'm with you. Miramanov's been just okay for me. And not bad. And that pairing with him and Weegar has still been fine. The best pairing has no question been Ball-Anderson. But Weegar, Miramanov, they've been fine. But, you know, Weegar never comes out of the lineup.
No, should he.
That guy's not getting rotated out. Neither is Anderson. And the way Ball's playing, neither is he. But you need, if you want to keep Barrie fresh, as you should, you're going to need to rotate somebody out. And so in this case, looks like they're rotating Miramanov out because if the guy's not named Anderson or Weegar, Miramanov's been the guy who's been the okayest of them all. So want to get Barrie back in. So Miramanov might have to rotate out. And again, Barrie was skating with Weegar, which gives you the impression that, hey, it might only be a one game thing for Miramanov. But, yeah, that's what it comes down to me, just the product of having seven guys you believe can play every day NHL minutes.
Yeah, and again, it keeps up that competition where outside of maybe Anderson, Weegar, and to a certain degree Ball, you can't get comfortable with your spot in the Calgary Flames lineup, regardless of if you're forward, regardless of if you're a defenseman. But particularly for that defense, competition should breed the best out of them.
He's Aaron Vickers at AA Vickers. My name is Pat Steinberg. Cam and Shan, our producers back at Sportsnet 960 World Control. As we start to wrap things up this hour has been the Sports Drive brought to you by Calgary Lock and Safe. Treat yourself with up to $500 in savings of fire-resistant gun safes. Explore the full line of safes at CalgaryLockAndSafe.com.